Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike. What five things are in your desert island fridge?
The leftover pizza from Pepe's that I had last night.
What kind of pizza?
White clam.
Okay.
Cotton candy.
Cotton candy.
I have never had enough cotton candy, even though when I get it, it's bigger than my head.
This week, our guests are Jane and Michael Stern, two people who inspired me and many of us writers to pay attention to iconic American foods. They have written more than 30 books, including the Bible for many of us, Road Food, in its many editions. The first edition was, in fact, published in 1977. They have also written numerous books on American pop culture, including Elvis World and the Encyclopedia of Bad Taste. And they have written for Gourmet Magazine, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic Monthly. Roadfood.com has been revitalized by Fexy Media, which we must acknowledge acquired Serious Eats at the same time. They have won numerous James Beard Awards and were inducted into Who's Who of Food and Beverage in America in 1992, which is a mere 24 years before I was inducted. So you guys, wow, that's impressive. Jane Stern has written movingly about her battle with clinical depression by becoming an EMT in Ambulance Girl, and has also written a book about her interest in tarot card reading. Welcome to Special Sauce, Jane and Michael Stern. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Hi, it's great to be here, Ed.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, man. I mean, we've got so many topics to talk about and not that much time. So
we'll talk fast.
All right. So first, I want to hear about life at each of your family's tables growing up. So your maiden name was Grossman.
Mm-hmm.
So life at the Grossman family table.
My mother was an absolutely hideous cook.
Me too.
Really, as every...
I think that's why a lot of people become food writers.
Probably. My mother did have the common sense to have two housekeepers. One, when she wasn't at our house, was the main line cook at the Horn and Hard Art.
I love that you had a line cook from Horn and Hard
Art
at your house.
Yeah, she was doing the big steamship rounds of beef. And the other lady, Maggie Barlow, was from Mobile, Alabama, and she was just a down-home Southern cook. So I grew up thinking that collard greens and pork knuckles was Jewish, New York Jewish food.
That's awesome. But the question is, because of the Horn and Hard, did you have to put a quarter in to get dinner?
Yeah, I didn't get any special dispensation.
I see. All right. What about you, Michael? You grew up in Chicago, right?
I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, real Midwestern boy. My mother was known among the family and others as the Michelangelo of Jell-O. She could make a seven-layer, multicolored Jell-O mold filled with every piece of crap known to mankind. And there, I mean, to that, I think that influenced me tremendously. I mean, my love of heartland cuisine has a lot to do with the way I grew up.
So wait, seven layers. I get marshmallows. I get chocolate, like
nuts,
mandarin oranges,
coconut, mandarin oranges, grapes.
Cranberry relish.
Oh yeah, and then sort of you make some opaque layers as well as translucent layers. I mean, they were magnificent and beautiful, and you know, just
they were objets d'art.
They were objets d'art. Yes, and plus, in addition to that, similarly, she was sort of a genius at back of the box cooking, by which I mean she would get ready-made things like Stouffer's spinach souffle,
right?
Something like that. But then do something extra with it. In other words, not
just
cook it.
So it was semi-homemade.
It was kind of semi-homemade, very creative.
She was semi-homemade way before Sandra Lee was semi-homemade.
Yes, it was extremely creative, but not from scratch.
Right. I still have all her Hadassah cookbooks, which are terrific. In fact, I just made the noodle kugel.
Oh, now, she made
yesterday.
Some great noodle kugel, actually, from scratch.
So both of you... But you loved the food that you had at home.
I loved it.
Yes, yes.
I never wanted to leave home because I just wanted to stay home and eat. And I actually didn't leave home till I was 21. Literally, I was too
busy eating.
I just wanted somebody to like make my bed and feed me.
You wanted to stay on the modified American plan forever.
Exactly.
I also have to say that one of the other tremendous influences on me is that my father was a traveling salesman and would go all around the Midwest and sometimes take me on those trips with him. So you know, when I was 8 years old, I was eating Green Bay-style chili. I was eating tenderloins in Iowa. I had no idea that this would eventually become my life. But
that's hilarious. And by the way, Jane, if you only left home at 21, that's early for a Jewish woman.
I could have been an Irish man and not left home until I was 55.
Exactly. So you both went to Yale, right?
That's when I left home.
Right. And that's where you met.
That's where we met.
But you weren't at that point intending to become food writers, right?
I was going to be a great director of motion pictures
myself.
Yes.
So you okay. And what about you, Jane?
Oh, God.
You were going to be an abstract expressionist painter.
Yeah, I was the female Willem de Kooning.
Ooh, that's really a reach.
Well, actually, that's really what I did.
Really?
I got my master's in fine art.
Wow.
I was a painter, and they were very sort of a cross between Philip Guston and
de
Kooning.
And they were huge. I mean, totally. Like,
really?
Her paintings were like 10 by 10 feet.
Really?
Yeah.
But let me tell you why I found Michael so attractive, aside from the fact that he was physically attractive.
Okay.
And he had a car, which nobody I ever knew in my life
had. Now we're
had.
Getting to really why she liked him.
But he was on a Woodrow Wilson fellowship at Yale, which meant that they paid him to go to Yale. So he was rich. He had a stipend every month, and he would take me out
he
and we
could
would
buy
eat
the pizza
in the car. We would go and get fried clams. We would go and do this. So, yeah, it was quite wonderful.
You liked him for his money and for his car.
And the clams.
What kind of car?
A Volvo. My first and last Volvo.
Very safe.
Yeah, it was very safe.
Didn't your parents give you a choice between an Austin Healey and a Volvo?
No, because I would have taken the Austin Healey. I'm sorry.
That's not a choice.
Changed when you're, over the years.
When you're 18 years old, that's not
no,
a choice.
No.
How did road food come about?
Well, the first book that we ever did was called Trucker, A Portrait of the Last American Cowboy. And Michael and I were both enthralled by the idea of long-haul truckers being these independent cowboys who wrote poetry to their trucks.
Because this was before the CB radio, so that truckers would drive all day and be really lonely. They'd be eager to talk and tell stories. So they would get to the truck stops and they would write songs, tell stories, and there was this whole kind of culture
wow.
of truckers that right. Jane documented in this
and
book.
And Michael and I were always very interested in folklore, so this is very folkloric. And we went around the country for 3 years with the truckers, following the truckers.
There was also a great deal of Jack Kerouac in our movement.
Sure.
The idea
Especially,
of hitting the road, discovering
yes.
America.
The romance of it.
Yeah.
So we kept a little diary because the truckers would say, you know, if I wasn't in this giant semi, I'd go 2 miles down the road to Ma Glockner's, you know, fish and fry. And it's the best catfish you ever had in your life. So we kept a diary of it. And after Trucker, which did very well, you know, in those days, if your book did very well, then you could basically, well, what do you want to do next?
Right.
Well, we want to write a book about regional American food.
No. First,
our
first idea was a book called Truck Stoppin' with an apostrophe instead of a G at the end.
Right.
It was a guide to truck stops, but that quickly evolved into a guide to regional food.
So we had no idea what we were doing. We just wanted to get in the car and drive somewhere.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
eat.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody's like, it's like, you know, I wrote my first book about New York food just
That's
because
right.
I used to drive my then girlfriend, now wife, crazy because every other block I'd say, oh, that place has the best tuna sandwich in New York. That place has great onion rings. It's like, this is so annoying.
I think the first time we hung out with you, we went up and down 2nd Avenue looking for some sort of a strudel that Nora Ephron had recommended.
Yes, exactly. At the cabbage strudel, the famous cabbage strudel story.
Right.
So I remember you telling me that so you got the contract to do road food, and this was before you decided you were going to hit every restaurant in America?
I don't think we had a game plan. I mean, first of all, to say we got the contract for road food, I think was like $3,000.
Right,
so,
$2,500. We thought we had scored.
Right, because we were living in a $99 a month, literally reconverted chicken coop in Guilford, Connecticut. So we just wanted to get in the car and drive. And we thought, well, we need a game plan. So we thought, makes sense that we should review every restaurant in America.
Never... Makes sense to whom?
Right. And we had, in those days, there were maps. So we opened the Rand McNally Atlas, and America was like...
Just
14
pages.
Inches.
Right. So this, and it was this all can pretty. Be done.
Right. Yeah, you know, absolutely no sweat. So I think the first 8 months of eating in every restaurant in America, we never got more than 2 miles from our house.
No, and we were at the Acropolis Diner, the Athena Diner.
The Ace
like, I don't think we ever got past the A's.
Right.
So at some point, we just decided, all right, we better just go somewhere, and literally it was lost in America. We had no idea.
Really?
Where
and going. And I was usually armed with newspaper clippings, magazine clippings. Did you not have that stuff? It was literally...
There was no computer, no GPS.
You were just dry.
I'll tell you, one of the things we did to find restaurants was to go to... We went to the New York Public Library, where there used to be... I don't think they still have...
The main one.
The main one. They used to have a room full of Yellow Pages from all over the country. And we would, if we needed to find restaurants in Idaho, we'd get down all the Yellow Pages from Idaho, browse through the restaurant ads, and see which ads looked kind of interesting. And in fact...
I remember,
I say Idaho because we were desperate to find good restaurants in Idaho. And I remember browsing through the Yellow Pages, we found one called the Spud Bowl.
In Coeur d'Alene.
And we thought, the Spud Bowl, perfect. Iowa potatoes. This is just what we're looking for. We drove 2,800 miles.
You know, an air-conditioned Beetle.
Yeah, to get to the Spud Bowl. And what we found was a bowling alley. That's why it was called the Spud Bowl.
To say clueless is probably a compliment.
Wow, that's a long way to make a mistake.
It really was.
But we probably found some good stuff on the way.
Yeah.
I mean, couldn't you have called them on the phone? I mean, you didn't need a cell
phone. We probably didn't even have a phone. I think actually
remember,
we
long
didn't.
Distance calls were very expensive.
They were expensive.
In those days.
That's true.
And remember, we literally did not have a phone because my mother would call like 12 times
yes.
a day and ask.
For a while, we had no phone.
If we were looking for work.
There weren't a lot of people writing about regional food, right? I mean, I guess Trillin was probably the first one. I mean, he was a profound influence on my life.
Yeah.
And my goal is to write a sentence as good as one sentence of his, you know?
Right.
And I don't think I'll ever do
I
it,
think
but
you do.
It's, you know, but like.
No, Trillin did it. And do you remember the Time Life cookbook?
Sure.
That came out around? Those were very influential because they first recognized that there
different
is this
regions.
Regional cuisine out there, and each of the regions has its own unique specialties. And I remember we had each of those well thumbed before we hit the road.
Who are your writing influences?
Actually, Seymour Britschke.
Sure.
Without a doubt.
Who
an
I
early
like,
restaurant
like
critic
write.
And had a newsletter and wrote for New York Magazine.
That's right. Right.
Yeah.
And he had the book, The Restaurants of New York.
Yep.
Really arch and really
there was a time when
vicious.
we could recite that book beginning to end.
Really?
Just because not only was he sort of insightful. He was such a brilliant writer.
So, Seymour Britschke. What about other nonfiction writers?
Well, oddly enough, and this is out of total left field, one of the most influential writers for me was Andrew Sarris. Do you remember him?
Sure.
Who wrote the American Cinema?
Yeah, he was the film critic for The Village Voice.
Exactly. I actually went to grad school at Columbia for a while and actually wrote a dissertation about the films of Douglas Sirk, and he was my advisor. And Sarris, even though he didn't write about food, didn't really care about food at all, had this wonderful way of sort of creating a taxonomy of what he was writing about.
Uh-huh.
Really well organized and really, I mean, his critical perspective was absolutely vital for me in creating my own.
Got it. And what about you, Jane?
I think that I'm the classic autodidact in that I had no mentors. I had no heroes we never took writing courses. We never went to journalism school. I mean, we just kind of figured it out as we went along. And I just thought, well, why, you know, what's so hard about writing about food? You know,
yeah.
Can't be that hard.
I was sort of that way. Except Trillin, you know, Trillin was, you know, I read Alice Let's Eat about 25 times,
yes.
You know, and it was just one of those things. So when you went on the road for that first book, like what were the five great discoveries like that just totally blew you away?
You mean actual places that we went
to? Yeah, or just foods. Could be foods and places.
Ma Groover's.
Ma Groover's Pig and Plate in Valdosta, Georgia. We had what Jane, having grown up in New York, thought that barbecue was Chinese spare ribs.
By the way, there's nothing wrong with that because they're excellent.
I agree.
I, growing up in the Midwest, thought that barbecue was cooking weenies on the Weber grill in the back patio. So Ma Groover's Pig and Plate was a real barbecue parlor. And, you know, this, I mean, the pork cooked for 18 hours, and she made this fabulous sauce. And plus, it was a real Southern down-home kind of place.
And she was quite a character.
Oh, yeah.
She didn't like Michael, so she took a broom and hit him over the head
Well, I think but then she got to, I kind of ingratiated
myself
to her
somehow. Didn't like him, because we look like
two hippies.
Did she
pay for the doctor's visit?
Yeah, she was an old lady, and it was a soft broom.
Didn't hurt.
But let's see, Ma Groover's.
How about the Tiwi Indian Reservation?
Oh, my God.
That was kind of a scary revelation.
In El Paso.
It was an urban Indian reservation in El Paso, Texas, the Tiwi Indians. And they had a cafeteria, and they served chili. And now Jane is sort of very machismo about eating hot food.
Mm-hmm.
No food is hot enough for Jane. Well, let me tell you, the chili at the Tiwi Indian Reservation was hot enough for Jane.
I actually passed out.
Really?
I couldn't
breathe. Wait, Jane, do you eat the hot chicken at Prince's?
Oh, yeah.
No, not the extra hot.
Not the extra hot.
Hot that she was trying to get revenge on her cheating husband?
No.
You know, as I've gotten older, I can't do it anymore. When I was younger, give me the hottest Szechuan on Broadway.
We were in Nashville. I was with the original general manager of Sirius Eats, and she insisted on ordering the hottest at Prince's.
That's crazy.
And so I said, really, I'm going to order the mild. We can have some medium. Do not start with the hot. And she did, and she took two bites. And we ended up having to stop at the gas station convenience store, get her as many stomach.
Oh, my God. I could not.
Yeah, it's rough.
Well, I don't know if you noticed, but all the hot chicken places in Nashville have these huge tankards of that alcohol hand wash. It's not for before the meal. It's for afterwards to get all that hot stuff off your fingers.
Exactly.
Yeah, do you ever rub your eyes?
Yeah, God forbid you touch
your
face.
Yeah, you'll burn your face off. So, all right, so the Indian reservation, the barbecue joint. What else? Give me three more.
Oh, I have a really weird one. The Indian Trail Tea Room in Winnetka, Illinois.
Yes.
It's a little old lady's tea room. And
Near his place of birth.
I used to go there with my family when I was a kid.
It was around the corner from Stern's Camera and Sound Center on the same block. But it was, I remember they had guest luncheon. It was like chicken a la king in a potato nest.
The wonderful ladies' tea room food.
Right. And, it was just, I just thought, God, I've never seen anything like this in
New
York.
Awesome. Yeah. So what's interesting in listening to you talk and also the way you write about food is story and context and pop culture sort of all get folded in seamlessly into the narrative.
That is the narrative. I mean, I know we've talked about this before, that for me, food on a plate in a vacuum is not very interesting. What's interesting is all of the connections it has, the people who serve it, the people who grow it, the people who eat it. All of that stuff really makes it. Of course, if it tastes good, that's wonderful. But it's all of that other stuff that makes it really
interesting. Yeah, and we have talked about this. And for me, the first bar that they had to hit or go over was, is it delicious? Then if it was delicious and there was a story, that was awesome. And for me, it was about discovering artisanal food and handmade food before people knew about – people called it artisanal food, right?
What we call road food radar, where you just kind of
– Absolutely.
You go in and it's like bing, 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 bing.
Totally.
It hits all the right –
You absolutely. And people would say, well, how did you know when a place was going to be good? I said, I not only knew when a place was going to be good, I knew when it was going to be bad.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And people would say, oh, come on. And I said, no, really.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a smell. There's a sense of place when you walk in. You look at the people and you look at how they're interacting with their customers and interacting with the food that they're serving. And you get it because you feel the pride.
You do.
You know, and you feel their sort of uniqueness, and you could also smell when somebody's a poseur.
Right.
Oh, yes. My favorite poseurhood story, well, it's not a story, but there's a barbecue near where I live in Connecticut that everybody thinks is the greatest barbecue.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And, you know, we smoke over oak and we smoke over mess. There's no smoke. You know, if there's no smoke, where's the pit? You know?
Right.
I mean, it's just.
Yeah, well, there's no smoke,
liquid
there's no
smoke.
Fire. Yeah.
Exactly.
So what became your favorite eating region?
Wow, that is so hard to say. Probably the South or Midwest.
I think in many ways, it's the South, for the simple reason that the South, probably more than any other part of the country, really treasures its traditions. And there are so many interesting ones. There's so, you know, because you have the African American influence, the Caribbean influence, plus, you know, Italian and stuff that we don't really think about as Southern, but you know, Louisiana being the ultimate example.
Sure.
You know, where there's so many
There's so many cross-cultural and cross-ethnic and cross-class.
Yeah. Right.
There's so many issues of race and class and ethnicity going into Southern food. It's fascinating.
It's like being in a foreign country.
Yeah.
You know, and even down to the basics that they could not understand what Michael and I were saying, and we could not understand what they were saying. You
because
know,
we talk way too fast. I'm
right.
sure this has happened to you a few times. You know, we talk like somebody from the Northeast. Bah, 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 bah. Slow down there, honey.
So we've talked about what writing the first book was like. You've been doing this a long time.
I don't think we know how to do anything else. I mean, seriously.
How has your thinking changed and does your approach differ?
Wow, that's a huge one.
I know.
I mean,
the
thinking is, here's how the thinking has changed. I can sum it up. At the beginning, when we wrote the first Road Food, we honestly thought that we were documenting the end of an era. That if we could have predicted back when that first book came out what it would be like today, we would have said it's all going to be super fancy food and McDonald's and nothing or hardly anything in between. In fact, that isn't true at all.
It's the opposite, that chefs are celebrating the regional
exactly.
foods that you discovered.
Exactly. I mean, we were pessimists when we started. I think we're much more optimistic
Interesting.
Now in terms of the future of American food.
Yeah.
We were at Knopf when we were doing that book, and Judith Jones, the
legendary cookbook editor who discovered
to be our
Julia
editor.
Child.
She refused to be our editor because she said, this is just crap food you're writing about.
On the other hand, just to give her her due, she did suggest the P&H truck stop in Vermont, which is a truck stop that bakes its own bread.
Oh, she had a house up there.
She had a house up there,
exactly.
That's hilarious that Judith Jones wanted nothing to do with the two of you because you were raffish, you know.
Absolutely. I remember we went to
a dinner party. Because we wrote about pies with Cool Whip on them,
right.
God forbid.
Remember at Liddy Marshall, James Beard, Liddy Marshall, her husband. And
Liddy Marshall wrote my favorite book about soup.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's a great book.
So we went to dinner at one of their houses, and they got into this long discussion about how difficult it was to find caul.
Yeah.
C-A-U-L. Which is caul
and I mean,
fat.
Right. And Michael said, what the f***?
What is it? We had no idea what they were talking about.
Anything what they were talking about.
We were saying it's difficult to find a good chili dog.
Right. Like,
that's awesome. So how has your approach changed?
Our job has gotten so much easier because, as you pointed out earlier, now everyone's interested in regional American food. And, you know, a day doesn't go by when we don't get a dozen interesting tips about places we need to. Next time we go to St. Augustine, Florida, you have got to go to Schooners or whatever. So in some ways, I don't know if our approach has changed, but our job has gotten way easier.
Oh, all of our jobs have gotten so much easier. Look, doing research for this interview. I remember when I would have to do research to do an interview, it was like pulling teeth. I'd pull my hair out. I'd have to go get microfilm, and I'd
remember
do this
Lexus
and do
Nexus
that.
That
Lexus
you're
Nexus.
Microfiche.
And now it's just like, I just Googled Jane and Michael Stern. I'm good. I'm good. I know more than they do about their life. You know,
I'm sure in a half hour. We're older than you. You haven't got a seat on
But I mean, it is interesting because that's the good part of the internet when it comes to doing what we do.
Do you want to hear what I think is the bad part?
Yeah, yeah.
In the good old days, you know, let's say at the New Yorker, you want to write a 30,000-word piece about a cafeteria in
Indiana.
Indiana.
We did.
sure, you know, 30,000 words, that sounds about right. You know, gourmet, same, you know, I mean, maybe not 30, right. but, you know, certainly.
Yeah, 5,000.
Right, 5, 10.
Yeah.
And now it's like, can you write a caption
can you write for a photograph? Words?
Can you do an Instagram feed for us?
A Twitter.
So, okay. Which is a perfect segue to roadfood.com. As I said in the introduction, both we were acquired at the same time, right?
Yep.
Road Food.
The announcement
was
always the two of us.
Yeah.
You were the big
in the New York
the big
Times
whale.
Yeah, I
and
don't
we
know
were
about
the,
that.
The little
but,
kiddos.
How has the internet and roadfood.com sort of changed? It seems like it's there's a lot. First of all, there's more voices obviously on the site,
right.
And but how has it changed what you do?
Well, I mean, in one very practical sense, it makes what we do much more practical in that, you know, if a restaurant goes out of business, we can take it right off the website. If it's in a book, we're just doing the very final proofreading of the 2017 edition of Road Food. And at the very last minute, three of the restaurants we listed went out of business. So we had to strike them from the final galleys. And, you know, probably between now and when the book comes out, probably a few more will go out of business. On the internet, that's not a problem. In
right.
a book, it is.
Right. But one thing I noticed, there were a lot more people contributing to roadfood.com. And this was even before Fexy bought you. How did you vet those people?
I had nothing to do with it. You
well,
answer.
There's really no so far there has been no formal process.
Got
people
it.
Who are really interested, who we feel get the Road Food voice.
If they hit a 10 on the obnoxiousometer, like the trolls,
well,
then
yeah,
we
obviously
kick them off.
No, but I mean, as it is now, to post a review on roadfood.com, it's got to go through us.
Got it.
And there are people who just who know what they're doing and do it well. What we're trying to do now is to expand the contributor base, and we are actually setting up some at least semi-formal guidelines of who can contribute and
right.
what they can contribute and how many times a month they can contribute and what they get paid to contribute even if they – so all of that we're working on.
So you're training the next generation – of Road Food contributors.
Yes, we're not going to live forever.
Yes.
And we would like roadfood.com to live forever.
You know, so. it's weird because Serious Eats is the same way. You know, I wrote everything
when
I started Serious Eats. And now, you know, Kenji Lopez-Alt, our Food Lab columnist who's become, you know, like an internet rock star
Absolutely.
Of the food world, said, you know, some people who work at Serious Eats don't even know that you used to write for the site.
Oh, dear.
It's like
my goodness.
It's a way to stick the dagger in really deep. But anyway, I think he was trying to be funny. But
the thing, what we're trying to do is, in addition to open it up to more correspondence, is actually to open up Road Food as well because, you know, Jane and I, what we know and really know very well, if I must say so, is like traditional regional American food. And I don't have to tell you, that's what American food is has been has always expanded.
Exactly.
Expanded. And we need people who are totally passionate about
a Bangladeshi food.
About Korean tacos.
We need a Kenji.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. American culture is constantly evolving.
Yes.
And the food culture especially is constantly evolving due to whatever immigrants have settled where.
And it's always been that way. I mean, you know, people often ask, well, what is truly, absolutely original American food? Well, maybe some Hopi recipe. But beyond that, it's all brought by somebody
exactly.
from somewhere else.
Yes. Yes. And that's what's interesting about it. So where are you looking forward to going next?
We're going to Pittsburgh next
Actually,
month.
our next trip is
really
to
good pierogies.
Is to Pittsburgh.
Oh, there's a lot of
cool. Oh, my gosh. Well, and one of our sort of the greatest of all Road Food correspondents, a guy named his screen name is Buffet Buster,
uh-huh.
is a Pittsburgh native. And he has taken other people on tours of Pittsburgh from which they come back exhausted and utterly happy. So Cliff Buffet Buster is going to show us some really good eats.
You know, people associate Pittsburgh with Primanti's, but there's so much more,
there
than Primanti's. Not that Primanti's is bad or anything, but you know, what's happened, this is an interesting thing about what's happened to a lot of the food that you all discovered, celebrated, is that more and more of those foods are finding their way into arenas
yes.
and stadiums. So
absolutely.
You go to Pittsburgh to Three River Stadium, there's a Primanti's.
Well, that's always an issue. True. That's an issue for us. I mean, there are now, what, 8 different Pepe's pizzerias in Connecticut and beyond. I mean, and that's all. I mean, and most of them that I've been to are very good.
Yes.
So that's not a problem. But, you know, that's happened with other places. Like, I don't know, there are several dozen Primanti's now
yeah.
all over the place.
I mean, Ed, we are so ancient that I remember when the only chicken wings, buffalo chicken wings you could get
were at Duff's and the Anchor Bar. That
right.
was it.
In Buffalo.
And nobody had ever
nobody
heard of them.
Knew
yeah.
what they were.
Yeah, yeah. That's so weird.
Yeah.
And now they've become a cliche.
Oh,
oh yeah, yeah.
Chicken
wings, the Anchor Bar. Like, what else do you have?
And a lot of people who eat buffalo wings have no idea that it has anything to do with Buffalo, New York.
Right, exactly. So what, in a macro sense, draws you to American culture?
I think because it seems so exotic to me being a Manhattanite.
So you were the ultimate sophisticate turned parochial person because you're a Manhattanite. So
yeah,
we're all sophisticated
prep
and parochial.
My school was a block away from here.
Right.
And, you know, I grew up on the Upper East Side. And when Michael and I would travel to, you know, and this is a big city by comparison, but Topeka, Kansas, you know, and we'd go into like Ira Price's cafe where, you know, I mean, it was just like cult, you know, it could have been.
So you were an
New
exchange
Guinea
student.
To me. Yes, I was.
You were an exchange student in Topeka, Kansas. Just
exactly.
admit it, Jane. And what about you, Michael?
Well, I'll tell you what fascinates me is the, how to put this, the different levels of culture that coexist in this country. Don't forget, the best-selling books that Jane and I ever wrote were not food books. They were Elvis World and the Encyclopedia of Bad Taste.
They were your pop culture kitsch books.
Contrarian books.
And both of those books are about how, like, sort of the dregs of culture is often brought up by the top of culture, sort of that intermix of high and low, which you see in food all the time. I mean, some of the most interesting things we've written about in the Midwest are these, like, farm wives who go to the trouble of making a leaf lard crust using cherries from the cherry tree in their backyard, making this utterly spectacular pie and topping it with Cool Whip. Because
sure,
because they like Cool Whip.
Because
yeah. that's what they had.
Because whipped cream is everyday stuff. Cool Whip
yeah.
is something really special.
Yeah, that's
and
hilarious.
I love that mix of things. There was that one lady, the radio homemaker of Iowa, Billy Oakley, who said one of her favorite memories from childhood was the first time her mother, who used to bake bread every Monday, went to town and brought back a loaf of Wonder Bread.
That's awesome.
It was a memorable moment in her childhood.
It's funny. Our new pastry editor and writer and recipe developer, Stella Parks, has written a whole book about elevated versions of iconic American sweets. So a homemade
like
Snickers.
Ah, yeah.
But
ah.
what she says something very interesting. She said after lengthy discussions with her brother, they're from Lexington, Kentucky, she said, her brother said, okay, Stella, your versions can be good and better, but they can't be too much better. And I thought that was such an interesting, nuanced view of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about.
Exactly. That it's, you know, so many of us who have had the privilege of eating high on the hog our whole lives, I think don't appreciate sort of what low on the hog eating can mean to people, how important it can be to their very
sure.
identity.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the most popular last meal for prisoners on death row is McDonald's.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You know,
that makes sense. Yeah, you mentioned the Elvis book, and the other one was the...
The Encyclopedia of Bad Taste.
Oh, yes, I have the Encyclopedia of Bad Taste.
Which you could not write now.
No.
What right. isn't bad no. taste
right,
now?
Right, because
there
is no difference.
There's no exactly.
The line of demarcation has been eliminated.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, it's true. So have you ever thought about, like, going beyond the U.S. to Canada or Mexico or...
You know, at Gourmet, they used to...
Every once in a while,
they
would send
us to
somewhere.
And it was sort of like fish out of water stuff.
Right.
You know, the Sterns in Paris,
right.
the Sterns in Rome.
Right.
You know,
and you said to Michael, we're not in Kansas anymore.
And it
the problem
was exotic,
with that. I mean, people have said, well, why don't you do the road food of France? The fact is, we don't know France.
Right.
You know, and what...
We know what we know.
We know the U.S., and therefore we can write about
sure.
road food in the U.S. But to do the road food of France, somebody would really have to know the culture of France way more than we do.
Now, we're about to go into the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. But first, Jane, you wrote a book about tarot card reading.
And I
know you're a lifelong devotee of,
yes.
of tarot cards. But Michael told us a little secret about this, and I'd like you to talk about it. He said, as long as you two have known each other, which is, what, going on 40 years?
More than that.
More than that.
You've never done his cards.
Is it because you don't want to know? No, I've never done my cards. You don't do people
you know
or care about. Because what if the death card and the tower card comes up? If I'm doing a reading, you know, for Joe Schmo, who I just met, you know, but if it came up for you, Michael, me, you know, I would be like freaking out. So you need...
You have to keep arm's length.
Exactly. It's like why doctors shouldn't do their own family
yeah, exactly.
as patients.
That's hilarious. All right. So it's time for the buffet, and you can answer individually because I think that you'll both have interesting things to say. So... First of all, what's in your desert island fridge? This question is made to order for the both of you because your desert island fridge, it is a fridge. It could be you've just come back. It could be shipped in from all over the country. So, like, what five things are in your desert island fridge?
Can it be the leftover pizza from Pepe's that I had last night?
Uh-huh.
Without a doubt.
Okay, what kind of pizza?
White clam.
Okay.
Cotton candy.
Cotton candy.
I have never had enough cotton candy. Even though when I get it, it's bigger than my head. It's like I just want to keep eating it.
I don't know. Does cotton candy keep?
In a refrigerator?
Yeah, no. But on the desert island where it's perfectly dry, it probably would.
Okay. All right. So keep going.
I would have a slice of that key lime pie covered in chocolate from the Key Lime Pie Company. Because that would be really good in a freezer. And that is like one of the most amazing sweet
The one food. In Brooklyn or the one
in... No, it's one in Key West.
Okay.
And they, you know, take a slice of key lime pie, perfect key lime pie, enrobe it in dark chocolate and freeze it. That's good.
The one in Brooklyn they do at Steve's, he does it on a pop.
Okay.
So it's the same thing.
That's smart.
Yeah, it's really smart.
That's great.
Steve's Key Lime in Brooklyn. So, all right, so keep going. I like this.
Caramel corn. From Chicago, from Garrett's.
Not the mix. It would just be the caramel corn?
You
don't want caramel and cheese. You're sort of mixing.
You know, I think the mix. Yeah,
I would go for the mix.
Because then my fingers would turn bright orange. And if I saw a ship going by, I could be rescued by waving my orange hands.
Who wants to be rescued with all this good food on your desert island?
I've noticed there's nothing green. There are no vegetables here.
Oh, gee.
How about some fried okra?
Kale, right?
All right.
No, you know what? I would really love to have a Louis Muller's brisket in my refrigerator.
So good,
you know how
man.
Good those are. People often say, "What's your one single most favorite thing?" I mean, and who knows? It depends day to day, but it's oftentimes Louis Muller's brisket
from Texas. Mm-hmm. His beef ribs are amazing, and of course Franklin's is the next iteration.
Right.
But all right, this is good. One more thing.
Okay, more candy.
You're such a sweet tooth.
To my number one food group, the honeycomb sponge candy from Antoinette's in Buffalo.
Oh, yes.
Do you know what that is?
Yes,
okay,
of course.
Yeah, with dark chocolate
on it. All right,
this
is good.
Now you know how we really eat.
So who's at your last supper? No family allowed. And
good.
It can be people living or dead. It can be writers, artists, musicians. Just like what would be the coolest?
This is the last supper?
The coolest table you could imagine putting together.
Can Jesus be there if it's the last supper?
Absolutely.
All right.
Oh, boy. Elvis, I would like.
You'd like Elvis.
I would like Elvis because I really like the food he eats. He'd be a great eating
Forget
buddy.
Forget about the music?
Exactly. Yeah. He's
you
pretty
wouldn't
cute
even ask him to
also.
Sing like Jailhouse Rock or
yeah,
anything?
Yeah, I just stuff him with peanut butter banana sandwiches.
All right. I like that. Elvis?
I think I would love to have James Beard and MFK Fisher there. We knew both of them, but never together. To watch them have a conversation.
So wait, this table right now consists of Jesus, Elvis, MFK Fisher, and James Beard.
All gods in their own way, right?
I love this. One more person.
One more person? Oh, my gosh.
Not Jack Kerouac, but his Partner.
Neil Cassidy. Because he was a great storyteller. Nobody else would ever have an opportunity to talk.
But he'd keep the conversation going.
Yeah. So we
and
just
he wouldn't
eat.
Be afraid to just talk to Jesus and just tell him what he thinks.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. I like this. And what are you eating?
Shrimp and grits. I love shrimp. Since moving to South Carolina, I have learned to really appreciate how good they can be if they're really good stone ground grits and good shrimp.
And there are so many bad versions of shrimp and grits
in the
world.
It's like chicken fried steak. You know, they're one out of 100 are really good, but the good one is great.
Right, because the bad ones just taste like cream of wheat with shrimp
exactly.
on top.
Exactly. It's so true.
All right, so what else are you eating? Shrimp and grits is a fine start to this meal.
Okay. Open-faced hot turkey sandwich, my absolute favorite food in the world, with two slices of white bread.
And mashed potatoes or frozen french fries?
Oh, no, mashed potatoes.
No,
with
never
a crater
fries.
To hold the gravy.
Gravy, of course.
Right, and peas.
And peas.
Like frozen peas.
Frozen peas. Okay.
Yes.
All right, this is a fascinating...
And a lot of gravy.
All
did
right.
we say gravy?
Yeah, brown gravy.
Did we say gravy?
Yeah, of course. Michael, you live in
I live in Aiken, South Carolina.
And Jane lives in Connecticut.
In Ridgefield.
And what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat? Like, what are the things that you'll just grab out of your cupboard?
Well, okay, I did make your mother's noodle kugel the other day because I always have some noodles and pot cheese lying around and a couple of eggs.
I personally love making pizza.
You do?
I absolutely love it. And I had a serious problem because the house that I moved to in Aiken had an Aga stove. Which with those little compartments in it, so my old pizza stone wouldn't fit in the goddamn Aga stove.
Send back the stove.
I know.
So wait, do you use a broiler or do you just bake pizza?
I just bake pizza in the convection oven. I use like regular old, you know, all-purpose flour. Nothing fancy about it. I mean, sometimes I'll get some fancy toppings for it. I mean, not too fancy.
Right. But so you always, since you'll always have tomato sauce in the house and you'll always have some kind of...
Yeah, sometimes without tomato sauce, it's fine too. Sometimes I just do basically like a garlic flatbread with some herbs. I'm fine with that.
Right.
You know?
All right. So this is a question that you may have already answered more times than I care to recall. Your guilty pleasure.
My guilty pleasure is eating the same meal every day for 10 days while I binge watch TV. And what I have been eating for the last 10 days is BLTs, really like good BLT sandwiches, and watching Beyond Scared Straight.
Give me your perfect BLT.
Okay, well, I do have to say that even though I go out of my way to not be a food snob, I do always use the D'Artagnan bacon because that really is my favorite.
That's delicious.
Tomatoes are in season now. What's better than that? L.
What
cares?
L do you use?
I just use
iceberg.
L. Yeah, like iceberg, whatever L is hanging around. I use Arnold toasting white bread.
And do you
and butter?
So
butter.
Jane does not put mayonnaise on her BLT.
Isn't this the strangest thing in the world?
That
is BLT blasphemy. What Kenji does, instead of toasting the bread, he actually browns the toast in the bacon fat, which is kind of genius.
Sounds kind of Elvis-like to
me. Yeah, it's kind of genius.
On both sides?
Yeah, it's amazing.
He is amazing, isn't he?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
It's cool. So if you could have a one-on-one, and I'll ask each of you this, if you could have a one-on-one lunch with anyone, just because you'd be so interested in what they had to say.
Is this a living person we're talking
about?
No,
could be anybody.
Living or dead person?
I think Hitler.
Hitler?
Because
he's got a lot of explaining
to do. He has a lot
do.
Of explaining
Besides,
to do.
Besides, he was a vegetarian. This would be a terrible meal.
It would be a terrible meal on many levels.
All right.
And then I'd kill him at the end of the meal.
All right.
Poison him. All right.
That's the last supper or the last lunch.
I don't know. I think if maybe with you, Ed. It's been a long time since we sat down to eat. You have so much to say, especially in New York. I mean, who knows New York better than you?
All right.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, this has been awesome.
Thank you, Ed.
This has been so great. Thank you both, Jane and Michael, for sharing your special sauce with us. The new edition of Road Food is coming out in 2017. Roadfood.com has had a complete makeover, and it really looks great, so everybody should check that out. it's just such a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you both because you, in part, inspired me to do what I do.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks for having us, Ed.
So long, Sirius Eaters. We'll see you next time.